You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. Coming up, the UW-Madison football team has a new head coach. We'll look at the dramatic change, some unanswered questions, and what it all means. Now, you may have heard the conventional wisdom that we're supposed to drink 8 glasses of water a day. Turns out that's based on not much. Our next guest co-authored a new study that tracked the way water moves through our bodies to try and find out how much we need to drink in any given day. Turns out a lot of the water we consume actually comes from the food we eat, and the amount of water we need to drink varies a lot from person to person. Dale Scheller is Professor Emeritus of Nutritional Sciences and Director of the Isotope Ratio Mass Spectrometry Lab at UW-Madison. Dale, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to join you. Usually I'd be driving home now listening to you.
Excellent. Well, you get to listen to me anyway. That works perfectly.
Now, okay.
I'm guessing you get asked all the time, how much water should I drink in a day? And it turns out there's not a one-size-fits-all answer. Why is that?
One, it's incredibly hard to measure. I mean, how much do you remember if you had 3 cups of coffee yesterday afternoon or 2 or 4? You know, we forget.
Yeah, so asking people their water drinking habits, I'm very precise on my coffee drinking, not so much on my water. So how do you, and this is really innovative, how did you try to measure the amount of water people went through?
Well, we used an objective stable isotope-based method. We give a tracer or a tag to that measures water metabolism, a deuterated water, that loads into the body and then washes out as you drink water or consume water in food during every day of the week. And it washes out about half of it in the first week. But from the elimination rate, the rate at which the concentration of that deuterium drops and decays over time in the body, you can back calculate to how much water is flowing through the body.
Interesting. I want to look at some of the different things that might say this person needs more than this person. And I guess one would be pretty obvious. The amount of physical activity we're doing, how much will that sway how much water we go through?
It has a large effect. It increases the amount of water that you lose as vapor every time you breathe in and breathe out hydrated water or hydrated air from your lungs. The person that's exercising a lot, if it's warm, they'll sweat and lose more water and have to replace that through drinking. So physical activity has a large effect.
Now, how about, say, men or women? You studied a lot of different people in this thing. Is there a difference about the amount of water that men versus women go through, given comparable situations?
There is a difference. In men, the water turnover is higher, so the water flux through the body is higher, and it's largely a reflection of their body size. Men are bigger, they have more muscles, they have more what we call fat-free mass, so they have a higher metabolic rate, and that affects water turnover and water needs.
All right, that's activity, that's men and women. Were there other big differences you found among people when it came to their water burn rate?
Well, the location geographically, in temperate zones, water requirements are higher due to sweat loss. And also, interestingly, on the other end of the equation, in high latitudes where it's cool and dry, because there's so much loss of water vapor through breathing, it's also high. It's sort of in the middle in this in the Wisconsin region.
Now, when I think of water, I think of water. You know, I'm drinking a glass of water, which I just actually emptied out before we started talking here. We get, as I mentioned, some of our water from other things, other beverages, and even the food we eat. How difficult does that make it to measure our water use?
Well, that makes it very difficult because you've got to then do a lot of work. You've got to ask every people how much food you consume. Apples contain a lot of water, for example. Soups contain a lot of water. So you'd have to inquire about their entire diet and then go to the books and calculate how much water came in from that. again, complicating the measurement that has been traditionally been done over tens of years in human water needs research.
Bringing things full circle, I've, asked the question myself, am I drinking enough water? And as a parent, I know many times I've told my kids they don't drink enough water. How do we evaluate? How do we know if we're drinking enough water or we should go to the effort of drinking more?
Well, fortunately, thirst helps a lot. If you're not thirsty, you're probably drinking enough, but you can't guarantee it. The next thing you can do is look at urine color. And I don't know if you've been in the armed services or not, but often in the latrine areas, they'll have a little sign with colored, what color is your urine? Is it light pale yellow, in which case you're drinking enough water, or is it a dark yellow with a little brownish twinge, which would indicate that you're really working hard to concentrate the waste products in your body and conserve water, and it would help to drink more.
Dale, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Great opportunity.
That's Dale Scheller, Professor Emeritus of Nutritional Sciences and Director of the Isotope Ratio Mass Spectrometry Lab at UW-Madison, with us today to talk about a new study he co-authored that tracked the way water moves through our bodies, determining how much of it we really need to drink in a day. Anybody else suddenly feeling thirsty? Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about community.
Where we live and the relationships we nurture have a big impact on our lives. Writer R.S. Eli Esparza shares a poem about the adventures and connections made in your neighborhood.
Las Chicas y Chicos de Blossom Street by Araceli Esparza. Door propped open with tree sticks, hanging out on Blossom Street with one step stoops. Welcome to my street. I'm Luz, Luz Maria if you're formal. Our days are filled with family news, pretending and playing, and tiny jumps. The day goes by and we dash from one playtime to the next. Chicas y chicos are girl kids and boy kids and everyone in between. This is us. We're like little picture moments at sunset. I live with my grandma, mi little sister Anna, a blind duck, and my tío. I like to hydrogarden, and I'm big on organic compost. They call me Mija. Izzy, my best friend, is learning to do perfect cartwheels. And like the sunshine, she almost pokes my eye. Next door, stuck in their room with Wi-Fi, clicking a keyboard and swishing a finger pad, Junior doesn't fix mofles, he fixes code. Night until day. Upstairs lives the twins, Paco y Pedro. Free time is dress-up time, and that's when Pedro wears pink. He banana smiles and drinks atole. Paco prefers green tacos and ham. When she wants to be like every boy neighbor, Ana plays the ultimate games and double dares us to race. She wins most of the time. With his empty cupboards, half-filled plates, our neighbor, Luis, comes over for grandma's tacos de jamón y pan. But on Sundays, he puts ketchup on his tamale. Best dressed with shiny white shoes and tapping toes, Beta has two puppies who swing her over puddles and carry her to pick the blooming lilacs across the street. Con los vecinos, our neighbors, we learn to ride our bikes in the parking lot. Together we have a cookout and be like family. None of us are related. Still, we talk, argue, and laugh like familia. Okay, let's race, Beta says, and her dress flutters against the wind. Ana, with holy toe shoes, makes up for time jumping over onion beds, while Mago speeds up and stops short at the corner. Her arms are ready for the Olympics. No one told her she couldn't walk. They told her she could fly. My friend Izzy gets stuck on Saturday morning meetings at the local Centro Comunitario. A stand-up-for-your-rights mommy equals tag-along girl kid. When she comes home, Izzy skips upstairs, finds her friends to compare drawings on tablets. The twins' place is always busy with parties. Viernes de quinceañeras, sábados de cumpleaños, y domingos de virgencita. Paco y Pedro wonder when all the cheek-pinching will ever end. four cheeks aren't enough. In the next building over, Juan, his three brothers and one sister, sleep tight as pea pods in one room they call theirs. In their dreams, they can be anyone. He asks me, when will the beans come up? Soon, very soon, I show him. Through the city's dusty roads, fresh air smells break through. Against the orange sunset, I step off my tio's troca and I am home. I smile at my garden. For me, all of them are my friends. We have aventuras, vidas, y laughter. Somos los de Blossom Street. We are from Blossom Street.
That was writer Araceli Esparza. PBS Wisconsin has created animation for her poem, Las Chicas y Chicos de Blossom Street. Head over to wisconsinlife.org to see it come to life. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, the highest paid public employee in Wisconsin, not a public radio talk show host, it's the UW-Madison football coach. And there's been a big change in the position. We'll get an update on the new hire to run the Badgers football program. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now we're going to tackle several questions and some answers about the UW Badgers football program. The team competes against Oklahoma State later this month at the Guaranteed Rate Bowl in Phoenix. There will be a new head coach on the scene. UW-Madison named Cincinnati's head coach Luke Fickle as the permanent replacement for Paul Christ. There are lots of unanswered questions, including the possible departure of the starting quarterback and the status of the defensive coordinator turned interim head coach. Jim Polzin is a columnist for the Wisconsin State Journal covering the Badgers, Packers, and other Wisconsin sports. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me. Well,
I'm guessing there are two separate groups of people in the audience, Jim, people following every twist and turn on this story over the last couple of weeks. Some people, maybe more casual fans, not on top of it. Give us the nuts and bolts for that second group. What happened with this big head coach change?
Yeah, there were a lot of twists and turns really over the last 2 months, I would say. Paul Christ getting fired was unexpected. That happened on October 2nd. I think a lot of people, myself included, thought that Jim Leonard, the interim coach, would, you know, just move into the full-time head coaching spot. And Chris McIntosh had a surprise for all of us and named Luke Fickle, who I think is a really good hire. It took me a little bit to wrap my head around that hire, just in part because I didn't see it coming. I think McIntosh did a really good job of keeping that under wraps and you know, not letting people know that he was even interested or Fickle was interested in Wisconsin. So I think it's a good hire. I think Jim Leonard would have been a good hire. I endorsed his candidacy pretty late in the process. And there's a couple of different ways they could have gone here. But I have no problem with the Fickle hire.
Now this happened fast. They posted the opening. And before I got my resume printed on fancy paper, this guy comes over from the University of Cincinnati. Why are people in the football world so excited about this coach?
Well, he spent 6 years at Cincinnati, which is, you know, for those that don't really understand the landscape of college football, there's Power Five conferences, the Big Five, and Big Ten is one of them. That's where teams like Wisconsin land. Cincinnati's in the AAC. It's called the American Athletic Conference. That's kind of the next tier down. And those are called Group of Five programs. And Fickle led Cincinnati, a Group of Five team, to a playoff appearance last year. They went 13-0, had a really impressive win at Notre Dame along the way, lost to Alabama, kept it, you know, somewhat competitive in the playoff. So it's a pretty impressive resume. It's 57-18 if you look at its overall win-loss record. I mean, I broke that down a little bit more in depth last year to kind of, you know, or last week, excuse me, to kind of point out that, you know, 57-18 is one thing, but you got to look closer than that. But he's a guy with Big Ten background. He played at Ohio State, coached at Ohio State, spent a year actually as an interim coach at Ohio State, and, you know, turned around a Cincinnati program in rather quick fashion. So the resume says everything you need to know about Luke Fickle, and I think he's a good fit culturally and just in philosophy. This is still a program that, you know, wants to run the ball, wants to play defense, wants to build from within through the high school players and develop them. Got a good Midwest background. So there's a lot of things that if you're naming the next Wisconsin coach, that you want to check boxes, and Fickell checks a lot of those boxes.
Talking to Jim Polzin, sports columnist at the Wisconsin State Journal, about the head coach change at UW-Madison and what happens next. And one of the big question marks, I mentioned the interim coach. You mentioned him, Jim Leonard. He was the defensive coordinator. He was the interim coach. A lot of people, including you, thought he had a good shot at getting this head coach job. Now what?
Yeah, good question. It's kind of it's been a waiting game. From what I know, and I wrote something pretty in-depth that appeared in this morning's State Journal, appeared online last night, just kind of breaking down why we've waited so long. Because, you know, Fickell and Leonard met already last Sunday, you know, 8 days ago, and then had a pretty in-depth meeting on Wednesday, and I believe they've met at least one more time. And from what I understand, Fickell wants Leonard, or has offered Leonard a spot on the staff. I think Leonard's in a position where he can be picky. You know, he's, for the last 5 years under Paul Chryst, he's run that defense with really no oversight. You know, Paul Chryst did not get in his business. He didn't meddle. He let Jim Leonard kind of run the show. And I think for Leonard to give up that autonomy would be a pretty big step back. And also, you know, I think he probably wants a say in what defensive staffers get hired. So there's a lot of, there's probably a lot being asked on Jim Leonard's part. And, you know, like I said, I think he probably deserves a lot of those things that he's asking for. And yet I can see Luke Fickell's side of this too. He's the outsider. If he comes in and gives up everything to, you know, like the way I referred to him today in my column was the golden child of Wisconsin, right? Jim Leonard, everybody loves him as a player, as a coach. So Fickell's got to decide, you know, how much do I give up? How much autonomy does Jim Leonard get? And, you know, it's a struggle. Now, I listed two reasons that I think this could work, and I'm not predicting which way this is going to turn out, but the two reasons I think this could work is that Jim Leonard's just a different guy. He's pretty humble, loves this place. I think he's willing to do pretty much anything to not move his family. He's got three young boys because he moved around a lot when he's in the NFL. So I think that's one side of it. The other side is Fickell, like I mentioned before, spent a year as an interim coach in Ohio State, got passed over for the main job, and stayed on staff for Urban Meyer at Ohio State. So he's kind of been in Jim Leonard's shoes. So if anybody can understand what Leonard's been through and is going through right now, it's Fickell. So again, that's not a prediction by any means, but that's just, I don't think this would work for any, just to any people. But since it's Leonard and Fickell, I think that's what gives it at least a chance.
Okay. So 6-6 this year for the Badgers, that, you know, this led to the midseason coaching change, a bowl. They're in a bowl. Not one of your premier bowls, I don't think. What are the hopes for improvement, I guess, under a new coaching regime next year?
Yeah, great question. I mean, the challenging part of answering that question right now is you just don't know who's going to be on the roster. I mean, you guys mentioned in your opener that Graham Mertz, the quarterback, has already hit the transfer portal. So you got to find a quarterback. You've probably got to find other key spots, because I think that transfer portal is going to fill up pretty quickly as guys you know, at least give themselves options for the future. So there's going to be some outgoings, and frankly, there's going to be some incomings too. I think Fickell could very well bring some guys along from Cincinnati, other places. So sitting here on December 5th and trying to predict what's going to happen starting next September is really, really difficult, because I don't know what the roster is going to look like and who's going to stick around, who's going to come in, how this recruiting class is going to look. Cause that's another thing. I mean, guys that Wisconsin has committed right now are going to have to decide whether they want to stay committed. And I think Fickell's going to try to flip some guys from other programs, including Cincinnati, to get them on board at Wisconsin. So it's going to be a chaotic 3 to 4 weeks. I think the early signing day is in a couple weeks, but I'm expecting full chaos in December. And that only gets us to a starting roster. And we really need to see how that roster would adapt to what Fickell's going to try to run offensively and defensively. So going to be a busy spring, going to be a busy summer and fall camp. And I'm going to hold off on any predictions on good they're going to be at this point.
I had seen, I don't remember if it was your reporting or not, Jim, the notion that a lot of the current players on the team like the idea of Jim Leonard turning from interim head coach to straight up head coach. Is there a thought that because of that, in part, other people might follow quarterback Graham Mertz and say, I'm going to see if other schools might be a better place for me?
Yeah, I mean, they were full endorsement of Jim Leonard, pretty hardcore as that process played out. And, you know, you know, a lot of things get said in the heat of the moment. And some of them are just that, you know, if Jim stays, I'm staying, and we'll see if they, you know, if they live by that, first of all. And we really need to see what happens with Leonard. If he stays on as defensive coordinator, I think there's a chance that some of those guys, especially on defense, stick around. If he leaves, I certainly think that improves the chance of them going elsewhere. The thing with the transfer portal, and, you know, I don't know, I'm not really sure of Luke Fickell's philosophy totally just yet, but you can put your name in the transfer portal and see what's out there, at least give yourself some options, and then decide to come back to Wisconsin. I don't know that necessarily means that every guy that goes in the portal is going to end up somewhere else. I will say that I think Graham Mertz is going to end up somewhere else. I don't want people to get hopes up, or, you know, the other way, that he'll come back. I think that's pretty much a done deal. So I think that's the caution I'd put out there, though, as this next week or two plays out, is that let's see where guys end up committed to before we start deciding that they're totally, the door is shut on them returning to Wisconsin.
Jim, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Jim Polzien, sports columnist for the Wisconsin State Journal. We talked to him today about a lot of UW football updates, including mostly related to the team's decision to hire a new head coach. If you're following that story, love to hear from you with your reactions. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll look at a U.S. Supreme Court case, arguments earlier today on same-sex marriage and whether service providers of various sorts, if they don't want to provide those services to a couple based on it being a same-sex marriage, do they have a right to refuse that service? We'll find out what happened before the U.S. Supreme Court today. Plus, from games to legends to those little origami folding word things, kids around the country share a lot of lore and customs. Where does it all come from? We'll check out some of the origins of why kids do the things they do. Plus, some great book recommendations. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll hear the latest story attached to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Wires and Fires investigative series about the risk of electrical fires in Milwaukee's neighborhoods. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the rapper formerly known as Kanye West has been sharing a series of extremist, anti-Semitic, and even pro-Hitler views. We'll talk to an expert on extremism about the way that these high-profile messages could affect online recruitment efforts by far-right extremists. First, electrical fires can be deadly, and an ongoing investigation from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel shows that in Milwaukee, low-income black renters face the highest risk. That series is called Wires and Fires. It found that landlords didn't often face consequences when bad electrical wiring caused a fire, and there was a lack of oversight from state and local government. In a new separate piece, one of the authors of the Wires and Fires series joined with ProPublica reporter Ken Armstrong to tell the story of a landlord, a tenant, and a house fire that ended in tragedy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you concerned about the risk of electrical fires where you live? Do you feel like you know how to spot the warning signs? What do you want to see from local or state governments to help prevent these electrical fires and the deaths they can cause? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Raquel Rutledge is a Pulitzer Prize-winning public service investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Her new piece is called The Landlord and the Tenant. A note to listeners, this next conversation involves some discussion of child abuse and harm to children. Raquel, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
You've been following this Wires and Fires series for a while. What led you to want to zoom in on this one particular story very intensively?
Yeah, well, this is a story that I've been thinking about for many years. When this fire happened in 2013, I remember thinking, what led up to that? Like, everybody was so focused on the mother and what happened with her and what she did. I wondered what the backstory was on how she got to the point of doing what she did. And I also wondered how there was so little attention paid to what caused the fire itself. And, you know, it was written off as sort of an accident at the time. And to me, that whenever we hear things, you know, are accidents, I just question that. And I wonder, you know, is it an accident or is it something that was preventable and even predictable? And as we found out, you know, years later, we've investigated this on a much broader scale and found out that often these fires are preventable and predictable.
Right. And this is taking us back to the original story that you referenced. Three children died in this rental fire. I want to meet the landlord and the tenant you write about. First of all, Todd Brunner was the landlord of this rental unit in West Allis at the center of the story. Can you introduce us to him?
Yes, that's right. Todd Brunner bought his first rental property when he was 20 years old back in the 1970s. He and one of his high school buddies went in on him. Todd Brunner had been a football star at New Berlin Eisenhower, popular guy, into cars, and he was on the prom court and elected as a senior class officer. Everyone said he was just a nice person back then. And he got into the real estate business with one of his high school friends. And they just took off from there, started buying more and more properties. And as his properties grew, he was known around Milwaukee as the foreclosure king, because he would really seize on these properties that others had lost in foreclosure to banks, and to such a degree that he had a desk, you know, at the when the sheriff sales were going on. He would be over there all the time and buying up these properties for relatively cheap. Sometimes $25,000, $30,000, and then not always maintaining them well. So he's a person that also filed bankruptcy kind of early on. He filed bankruptcy in 1992 and then again in 2011. And at that point, he owned upwards of 200 properties across the Milwaukee area. And as he filed bankruptcy, he got into trouble because the bankruptcy courts started to realize that he was not upfront about his bankruptcy, about his property ownings. He was hiding some of his properties, and he owned a bunch of cars, including like a Rolls Royce and a Bentley. And he had Harley motorcycles and fast boats and all kinds of what he called cool toys. And he was trying to hide them from the bankruptcy court. So he got into trouble that way.
And in addition to the fraud investigation that led to, when you go through city records in Milwaukee and the surrounding area, his name frequently appeared, it seems like, for various kinds of violations in rental properties, including safety violations.
That's right. I mean, he racked up so many at one point that he had 11 warrants out for his arrest because he neglected to fix these things. And then he would incur fines and he wouldn't pay the fines and he wouldn't pay taxes. At one point he owed back taxes for 29 municipalities around the area and upwards of $100,000 in fines that he didn't pay and taxes that he didn't pay. And yeah, we just found when you went through his properties, there were a number of, I mean, he had a number of fires at his places, and people complaining about shooting sparks out of their electrical outlets. So he was well known to code enforcement officials in Milwaukee and in some of the surrounding suburbs as well.
Talking to Raquel Rutledge from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Her new piece is called The Landlord and the Tenant. Let's meet the tenant who is at the center of the headlines you referred to, Raquel, Angelica Belen.
Yes, Angelica Belen was first actually in the news back in the 1990s when she was a small girl. She was 3 years old and her little sister was found beaten and starved in her crib on the south side of Milwaukee. And her mother and her mother's boyfriend were arrested and convicted for the homicide of that little girl. And so Angelica became a ward of the state and moved through the foster care system. She and one of her other little sisters, her mother had at that time had seven children. And so Angelica and her little sister, Rosalie, stayed together and were put in foster homes. And they moved throughout. And in a number of the foster homes, they were subjected to severe abuse. You know, the records and interviews with Angelica and her sister have substantiated some of the horrendous things that they suffered throughout their childhood.
At the time of the fire, then, at a house that had been previously owned by Todd Brunner. I think it was in foreclosure. Can you talk about Angelica's life at that point?
Yeah. So Angelica then, as she got older, she was in relationships with abusive men. She ended up having a daughter, and then she had twin boys, and then she had another child after that. And three of those children had special needs. And Angelica was 24 when she rented the place from Todd Brunner, not knowing any of the history about him or the place. She had been struggling, living in her car and living in a shelter and just struggling to take care of these kids that had special needs. One of them had epilepsy and autism, and one had cerebral palsy. So they just had high needs, and she was really struggling to take care of them. And so she had left them alone a number of times and had been warned not to leave them alone, to which she said, when she was a child, she was left alone regularly in her foster homes, and no harm had come of it. So she was sort of brought up that way. And when she rented the house from Todd Brunner, she didn't know the background, but we interviewed the previous tenant of that home, who told us that the electrical system in that home had been a mess and that she had complained about it as well. The lights would flicker on and off all the time. The light bulbs would burn out. I mean, she said, she thought there were ghosts living in there because the electrical system was so terrible, that as she went back one day to pick up her mail after she had moved out, and she ran into Angelica there at the house and was surprised. She asked her, had they fixed anything? And she said, hey, they should not have let you move into this place because it's a danger. And Angelica Blinn was definitely struggling. The social services had been involved with her in weeks prior to the fire, and trying to really help her figure out ways to get her children to their appointments, get their medications filled, and get some care set up for them while she worked. She had just recently gotten a job as a hostess at a Chinese restaurant and was headed to work the day of the fire.
We're talking to Raquel Rutledge, public service investigative reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at her recent investigation with ProPublica called The Landlord and the Tenant, and her ongoing series about electrical fires in rental properties. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk about a new investigation from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and ProPublica called The Landlord and the Tenant. Raquel Rutledge from the Journal Sentinel stays with us to look at electrical fires and faulty wiring in rental properties. We've met the landlord and the tenant now. Raquel, take us to April 11th, 2013. Angelica makes a decision to leave her kids at home while she goes to that job you mentioned, and the electrical system finally goes wrong.
Well, that's right. Yes. So Angelica, got up in the morning, did what she does in the morning, got the kids ready. Her oldest daughter ready for school. She drove her across town to a Lutheran school, and the boys, she would, often take the boys and her youngest with her. Her youngest son at the time, a 17-month-old, was with his dad that day. So she was with her twin boys and her daughter. After she picked up her daughter from school, she had a shift at the Chinese restaurant where she worked, which was about 6 miles away. And she was scheduled to work from 4 till 7. And she had been struggling. This is only her third shift at that job. And the prior shift that she had a few days earlier, she got some neighbors to watch the kids because a neighbor she didn't really know very well. But she was scheduled to have subsidized daycare set up the following day. She was scheduled to go to the county to get that all set up. But so this day she did not have that. And so she called one of her sisters. She called around a neighbor. She tried to see if she could get anybody to help with the children, and she could not. And she felt like she needed to be at work or she would lose that job. So that was her thinking when she put the kids up in the boys' bedroom. She hugged them. She kissed them. She said, "I will be back, in a few hours. Play with your toys. I'll bring you a cookie when I come home, and we will have spaghetti for dinner." And she left them in that room. She closed the door behind her and she locked it, and she went to work. And about an hour later, a neighbor went out to let his dog out to go to the bathroom, and he noticed smoke coming from the roof of that house, and he called 911. And fire officials arrived on the scene. Neighbors gathered around the porch, and didn't think anybody was home because I had seen her car leave. And so they, you know, they said the house is empty. The firefighters go through and do what they do, you know, kind of sweeping from the ground floor up. When they came to the boy's bedroom and found it locked, they broke it down, but the smoke was so thick they couldn't see in there. And what they could see was a hole in the floor. And so they were called off because they realized the floor was unstable. They couldn't go any further at that point. And so they retreated. And at about 7 p.m., Angelica clocked out of work a few minutes after 7, and she drove home. And when she got close to her neighborhood, she could see all the fire lights, fire engines and everything. And she was blocked from getting closer to that by the, you know, the police had blocked off the area. And she started asking about, hey, what's going on? And they said, there's a fire. And they asked, you know, she asked questions about which house. And as they started to describe it, she started to realize it sounded like it was her house. And she just got out of the car and started running and just ran past everybody and up into the yard and asked about her children. And the firefighter said there wasn't anybody in there. And she said, I, you know, are you sure? Are you sure? I think, you know, and I think my kids are in there. And so they went back in at that point and climbed up into the boy's room through a ladder from the outside and found the three children under a dresser huddled together. They were all killed. And so they arrested her fairly quickly, and she was taken to jail and interrogated. And initially she said she left her kids with her sister, and that she didn't lock the door. And ultimately, after several hours of interrogation, you know, she acknowledged what happened. And she was charged with child neglect that resulted in death in the case of, you know, all three children. And ultimately she was sentenced to 18 years in prison. So she is now 9 years into her sentence, and, you know, has nine years remaining.
She faced, as you say, 9 years remaining. What ultimately caused the fire when they went in and looked to try to determine the cause?
Yeah, so they did an investigation and they found that it did start behind the wall in the kitchen. And it was a light bulb that she had complained about. She knew it wasn't working. She just said she never used that light because every time she put a light bulb in it, it would burn. It was burnt out. And so they confirmed that it was indeed electrical. And when the investigators went in to look at it, they said they had never seen such crazy wiring in their experience, in their history of looking at this stuff. We saw pictures that they shared of the police department in the police file. There were spliced wires that were plugged directly into an outlet. It was a fire trap waiting, you know, just a fire waiting to happen with that kind of wiring that was in that house.
As you mentioned, Angelica Bullen faced consequences, still in prison now. Were there any consequences for the neglect of the electrical system in the house that ultimately caused the fire?
There were not. Officials pursued charges against Todd Brunner. He was convicted of 3 felonies for bank fraud and bankruptcy fraud, but no charges were ever filed. The judge in the case said he would have thought the prosecutors would have brought something along that line. The prosecutor said the police never presented them with any evidence along that line of thinking. And then when we interviewed the police detectives, they just said, hey, we never went that direction. You know, all the focus was on the mom and the fact that she left those kids alone.
Talking to Raquel Rutledge, investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and her story, The Landlord and the Tenant. Broadening out now to the wider issues of the faulty wiring in rental properties, is it common for landlords to face consequences if it's found that the wiring in their houses was a problem, it caused fires, and had gone unaddressed in the past?
It is not common. It is not common at all. And though all the attorneys that I've spoken with, and like I said, the judge and the prosecutor say it is possible. That is a line of pursuit that is, you know, it is possible. There's a 3-year statute. Well, not when deaths happen, but there's for wrongful death suits, there's a 3-year statute of limitations on the state side of things, for civil liability. Angelica Bullen did try to sue Todd Brunner in federal court in 2020, but that was dismissed due to just jurisdictional issues on that front. So, yeah, it is rare, but it's not impossible.
is there a recourse for a tenant living in a situation where they say, hey, I'm seeing obvious electrical problems and my landlord isn't addressing it?
You know, it's a great question. There's a lot of fear among tenants, and, you know, rightfully so. We found that, you know, they fear repercussions from the landlord. They fear of being evicted. Angelica Belen had been evicted previously, and so she was worried if she complained that she would be kicked out and become homeless again. And so a lot of times, you know, there aren't complaints. And so, I mean, the recourse right now for folks is to talk to, you know, the Common Council in Milwaukee, talk to local legislators, talk to the state. The state legislators really gutted some of the tenant protections back in 2015, really tying the hands in some ways of local municipalities, making it more difficult and making it somewhat cost prohibitive for them to do rental inspections that are proactive, like getting in there on a routine basis so they can have eyes on and flag some of these hazardous conditions, which we found are extensive in Milwaukee. There are a lot of people living. These conditions still exist in many, many rental properties in the area. And so it's going to take an effort by local and state government to really address this issue.
Can you remind us of some things a renter might see around their apartment or rental house that could be a problem?
Sure. I mean, there were some things that I was sort of surprised at when I started investigating this too. One of the things is like a loose outlet. When you plug your cord into an outlet and it falls out, that is a dangerous hazard that can create arcing and sparking and can catch curtains on fire or a couch on fire, a nearby couch. Flickering lights. And, you know, when you see that, that's a symptom. Wires that, you know, if you have outlets that don't work, what we found in a lot of the rental properties is as people would use extensive use of extension cords. And they often, you know, they're often blamed for doing that. Hey, don't use extension cords. But when you have one outlet that might work in your room, or sometimes no outlets that work and you're forced to use extension cords from other rooms, those things are known to be very dangerous and cause a lot of the electrical fires as well.
This particular story we've been talking about is in West Allis. A lot of your reporting had been in Milwaukee itself, and there's been some reaction. You've reported on this two-year series from city officials and others in Milwaukee. Has there been any kind of action there to try to tackle this problem?
Well, some state lawmakers did introduce a bill last session. They're talking about reintroducing this session coming up. Didn't go anywhere. It's right now. It's just they've got Democrats and they're needing some Republican colleagues to sign on with it. And locally, there is definitely. I'm following up with some of the local lawmakers. They too have talked about mandating insurance. Some of the things we found in our early reporting was that the properties weren't insured. And when they're not insured, they don't always get a full investigation because oftentimes the ones that do these investigations are insurance companies because they want to get to the bottom of what caused the fire. But if there is no insurance, sometimes it's just written off as an accident. That was not the case in the case of the fire for Todd Brunner's home. But that is common in Milwaukee when people are buying properties for $10,000 or $15,000. They don't always have them insured. So there's talk about mandating insurance for rental property owners and figuring out ways to resurrect inspection programs.
And you've been following this for some time, Raquel. What are you watching for next?
You know, that is what I'm watching for next, is to see how local and state lawmakers respond to these types of situations, because so often it's happened year after year where people are being killed in these fires and they're continuing to be written off as being accidental. And what we have proven is that they are not. They are. Fire experts say these types of fires are very preventable and predictable.
Raquel, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you for your interest in the story.
That's Raquel Rutledge, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, with us today to talk about her latest investigation with ProPublica. It's called The Landlord and the Tenant. You can find a link to it at wpr.org/centraltime. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to an expert on extremism about the anti-Semitism shared by rapper Kanye West and how those ideas seem to be reaching more and more mainstream audiences in recent years. I'm Rob Verrett. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.